This evening, as we continue in this third chapter of 1 Peter, we're staying really in the seventh verse, where he's speaking about the duties of husbands in the marriage relationship. And we are trying to pick out some of the pertinent scriptures in the New Testament now that will teach us about this marriage relationship, because he tells the husbands here to dwell with them according to knowledge. And that would mean then that he would have to dwell with the wife according to the knowledge that God has given, according to that part of God's will, which is applying to the marriage situation. That is the knowledge that we apply and that the husbands apply. Well, you cannot apply knowledge if you don't have it, because knowledge happens to be the facts that God would teach about a certain subject. And so this is what we're doing now. We're spending some time teaching what these various scriptures do about the marriage relationship, so that this husband then, and of course the wife too, can dwell in the marriage relationship according to knowledge. You know, there is no relationship that any of us have that is more basic than that of the family. There are many people in the church, of course, but there are probably no persons who do not have a family or who are some way related to a family. And if not, then there is something radically wrong with you as a person. Maybe it's not your fault. Maybe it's not, you don't have any control over it. But you have missed on the normal relationship and the normal pattern which God has planned for his people and for all people. That is to be related somehow to the family. First of all, as infants in a family that we're kin to, and then later as a husband or a father in a family that we then are have made and are responsible for. We've been studying from Ephesians, the fifth chapter. This morning we had studied from the 21st verse of Ephesians 5 down through verse 29, and this is still talking about the relationship now of a man to his wife, and he is comparing the relationship of a man to his wife with the relationship of the church to Christ. And he's told the people here, Paul has, "So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself, for no man ever yet hateth his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we're members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones." Now, we've made this comparison earlier this morning, but this evening we want to begin with this passage here. And what he is really teaching here is that we have a unique relationship with Christ as members of the church, a relationship that does not exist any other place, and it is very similar to the marriage relationship, which is also unique. For the next statement says, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh." Now let's notice this for a moment. This relationship described here is one that you're not going to be able to read about any other place except the Bible. Very few people really understand what he's saying here, and the very uniqueness and completeness of this relationship. He's comparing a natural relationship here with a spiritual relationship. Notice, we as children are born into a family in which we can have a mother and a father. Now, we're not able to choose what family we're born into. We're not able to choose the parents that we have. We can't choose whether or not they're going to be Christians, or whether or not they may be idolaters. They may be ungodly people. They may be rich people. They may be poor. They may be people of a high moral character. They may be people that would be very degenerative. We have no choice over this. We're born into this family. It's a natural relationship, but it is a strong tie. Our ties with our mothers and our daddies are strong ties. And the Bible verifies this in many ways. But the relationship that we have with our husband or our wife is a different relationship from this, because in it, we do have a choice. We can choose what person we marry. We can choose what kind of a person that is. We can determine whether they are of a high moral character, whether they're a Christian, whether they are going to be good for us or not good for us. We're told to choose, to marry whom you will, only in the Lord, you know. But we also can choose not to marry that person. It's a free choice on our part. And the thing here is, though, once we make that choice, it's voluntary on the part of both parties, but once the choice is made and once the thing is done, then that tie becomes stronger than the relationship that a man has with his mother and his daddy. And so he says, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh." It's a stronger tie than that natural marriage tie that you have, than that natural fleshly tie that you have when you're born into a family. A stronger tie than that. Now, most people don't realize that. Most people think that I'm still real close to mom and daddy, and this person I married, you know, I can get rid of them anytime, but I can't get rid of mom and daddy. The Bible teaches that for this cause, this tie is so strong, this bond is so unifying, that a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined unto his wife. And he compares it to the tie that he just mentioned there in verse 30, "For we're members of his body and of his flesh and of his bones," the tie that the church has to Christ. There again, that's a voluntary tie, a voluntary relationship. We do not have to be joined to Christ if we don't want to be. But once we make the choice, once we make the voluntary decision to do it, that tie supersedes all other ties, all other bonds. And to violate that bond, then, is spiritual adultery. And the same is true concerning a man and his wife. If they violate that bond, that is spiritual adultery. You know, your mom and daddy can kick you out of the house and disown you. Or you may find it necessary to have less association with them for some reason or another, in which it wouldn't be adultery. But to violate the tie of the marriage bond would be adultery. Now, we're beginning to see then just what a unique relationship this is. Why it is that the man is the head over the wife, and why there must be one head, and why this uniting of these two people then function as one unit, as one organism, as one body. Their tie is so strong that it's stronger than the tie that a man has with his mother and his father. Now, the world doesn't understand this, the world doesn't know this, but the Bible teaches it so plainly. And it was from the very beginning, the Genesis relationship, the Genesis teaching in the very beginning taught that this relationship would be this strong, that he'd leave his father and mother and would cleave his wife, and they two would be one. Now, as we think of this then and the ramifications of it, over in Luke 14, verse 26, we have what I think is a good commentary on this subject, on this relationship. Now remember, the relationship that applies between husband and wife is even greater and even stronger between the Christ and the church, or a Christian and Christ. So Jesus said in Luke 14:26, "If any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, in his own life also, he cannot be my disciple." Demonstrating the strong relationship of the spiritual tie between a man and Christ. He said, "You cannot be my disciple unless you come to me and regard all other ties as lesser ties than the tie with me." And not only that, but his own body also, his own life. You must even regard your own life as being something less than the importance of this tie that you have with Christ. He says, unless you have that attitude, you cannot be my disciple. So we're beginning to see now how strong our allegiance must be to Christ because of this unique bond that we have. But he compares it to a man and his wife. They also have a bond very similar to that. A man must love his wife as his own body, just like Christ loved the church and gave his body for it. And so it's a unique relationship. A man must love his wife to the point that he'll leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain would be one flesh. And so he says in verse 32, this is a great mystery. Ephesians 5, this is a great mystery. But I speak concerning Christ and the church. Now it is a great mystery. It's something the world doesn't understand. It's something our natural selves do not perceive. Were this truth understood, there'd be no such thing as divorce, not to mention divorce and remarriage. This would be something that would be unheard of were this truth understood. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. And of course, we've demonstrated in earlier teaching on this passage the relationship that it does show of Christ and the church, and it's also demonstrated between man and his wife, that relationship. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. So we begin now to see what Peter may be referring to when he says, let them dwell with them according to knowledge. There's a lot to learn and a lot to know about this relationship. It's a relationship that is so unique, that is so different from all other relationships, that it takes the Bible to point it out to us. No other book that I know of really has discovered this truth outside of getting it from the Bible. Now, somebody may be teaching about the Bible and write a book about what the Bible says, yes. But so far as discovering it from philosophy and from other sources, I don't know of any other book that has really gotten this truth down. That there's two kinds of relationships. One's a voluntary, which we choose a husband or a wife, and the other is a natural that we have no choice in, and the voluntary takes precedence over that natural one. You know, as we mentioned this morning, it's the same thing being born into a nation. We're born into a nation like the United States of America, and we have no choice over what nation we're born into, but we do have a strong obligation to that nation to obey the law since we're born there and we're citizens there. But yet, being born into the kingdom of heaven, which is another nation, that's a voluntary birth, a voluntary citizenship that we take because we want it and we work for it, and the bond to it is a stronger bond than the natural citizenship that we have to whatever nation we're born into. So this is a great truth. It's a great mystery. But he says, I speak concerning Christ and the church. So the more we understand about this, the more we understand about our relationship to the church and Christ, and also then the more we understand about that relationship, the more we can understand about the relationship of the husband and the wife, because they're used as comparisons. Now we're talking about the duties of husbands. And of course, it's just as well for wives to know the duties of husbands as it is for husbands to know it, because this is such a close tie that one cannot function and exist without the other in that relationship. So we want to look at another passage now in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. We have some more very good teaching here given to the church about marriage. 1 Corinthians 7, beginning with the first verse. Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now they had apparently written Paul some questions, and now Paul is endeavoring to give an answer to some of those things that asked him about. And so he says it's good for a man not to touch a woman. That is, it's good to remain in the unmarried state. But let us not water down what Paul says. He said it's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, to be in the unmarried state, then, what he's really saying here is, if you're not going to be married, when it comes to women, hands off. It's good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, not good for a man not to be married and yet to live with a woman like he's married, or to act toward a woman like he's married. That's not what he says. He said it's good for a man not to touch a woman. And the same would be true vice-versely. It'd be good if a woman's not married, then for her not to touch a man. That's what he's really saying. If you're going to be unmarried, you're unmarried. You don't touch a woman. Sometimes we just use that in a kind of a figurative sense. Say, oh, well, it's all right to, you know, it's all right to have dates and have some strong ties and relationships and so on and so on and so on. We just don't go to the trouble of getting married. No, that's not what he says here. That's not the single state that Paul has described. Nevertheless, he says, verse 2, to avoid fornication. Now, the word fornication here would have to be in the broad sense, which includes not only sins between unmarried people, but also the sins of married people. It would include adultery also. And to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Now, this is the Bible way. This is speaking about the sexual relationship that is involved in marriage. It's the Bible way to avoid the sin of fornication. A sin that is so common that every community is touched with it. And rare is the family that is allowed to escape it. A sin that is so common that the Bible speaks about it over and over again. Each one of us has the potential of committing this dread sin. A sin that is so deceptive that persons mistake it for love. A sin that is so deceptive that persons think that it is a good thing, even though it's used in a bad way. A sin that is so deceptive that sometimes there seems to be a thin separation between whether it's really acceptable to God and not acceptable. Here in one set of circumstances, it's wrong. And another set of circumstances that are very, very similar, it's right and good and holy and proper. It's deceptive, and we're to guard against it. And so the Bible gives us God's plan. Nevertheless, he says, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. So that do not attempt to live in this unmarried state if fornication is a factor in your life. Then he further explains this in verse 3 of 1 Corinthians 7. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. Now this benevolence here would be something that was a gift that belonged to them. And he's talking about the sexual relationship. And he says, let them render unto them due benevolence. When you give due benevolence, it's something that you owe to them. It's something that they deserve to have, something that belongs to them. It's theirs, it's their possession, and you're only giving what's due. You know, in anything, when you pay your dues, you're paying what you owe. Dues are not counted as a gift, but dues are something that you're obligated and that you owe to something. And so, in the case of the husband and the wife, there's something that's owed one to the other. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. Now, this is the way God has provided for his people to avoid fornication, and it's to be done in the marriage state. You have your own wife, and you have your own husband. This is the way to do it. And you render to each other what he calls your due benevolence, owed benevolence. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. Now here again is another very deep truth that the world does not understand. You know, everybody says, well, this is my body. I can do with it what I will please. I can use it any way that I want to. It's mine, it's my possession, and nobody else has anything to do with it. But that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says that the wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. She does not have the right. She does not have the privilege. She does not have the God-given power to use her body like she wants to. She cannot give it to anybody that she wants to. She cannot let somebody else take this possession that belongs to her husband, but it is something that only the husband has the power over. And then he, of course, says likewise, hath the husband not power over his own body, but the wife. His body belongs to the wife. And it's not anybody else's possession. So any time that you have fornication involved or adultery involved, there's a robbery taking place. There's a robbery of a body taking place that belongs to somebody and it's being taken away from them. Now maybe you're young enough that you haven't met your wife or your husband yet. Still, if you commit fornication, you're giving that which is to be preserved and reserved for your future wife or husband. You're giving it to somebody to whom it does not belong, and you're robbing your future spouse of their possession. You're robbing them of that due benevolence. You don't have power over your own body in that way. The only thing that you are to do is to preserve that body until the time comes in which ever, or you then as a husband can have your own wife, or you as a wife can have your own husband. And so he says in verse 5, defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. Incontinency would mean the ability to maintain self-control. Now he recognizes here that since this marriage relationship is a way to prevent fornication, the way to prevent it, when it's properly used, that they do not hold back that which is due to each other, he recognizes that if there comes a time in which they're going to have to be separated, that there is a very great temptation during that time. if you are separated, that you should do it for a set length of time. You should know how long the separation is going to be and when you're going to get back together. And you should do it for a good purpose, such as for fasting and prayer. And then when you come, whenever that period is over, you come back together again, lest Satan tempt you for your inability to maintain self-control. The Bible recognizes that that is a time of temptation. Many husbands and wives don't seem to recognize this. They use the sexual relationship in improper ways. They use it as a punishment sometimes. You made me a little bit mad. You're not doing what I want to do, so you sleep in the living room tonight. You know, you're not going to share my bed. The Bible speaks against that. It's not to be used as a punishment or as a reward. That's not the purpose of it at all. As a matter of fact, when a wife sends her husband out of a day to work and something has been held back from him, this due benevolence that he should have had and that he desired and it was held back from him, then she's sending him out with an extra burden on his shoulder that day, an extra temptation. Satan has an extra end to tempting him that he would not have had this wife done her duty. And the same applies vice versa to the husband. And the Bible teaches it so plain. We're not reading something into this. We're not resting or twisting these scriptures to get this meaning. It's plainly here. This is what he's saying. So when you do have to be separated, let it not be under those circumstances that he calls here, defraud you not one the other, except it be with consent for a time. You both agree, and you both agree how long it's going to be. It's for a good purpose, and then when that time is over, you come back together again. So this would eliminate a couple just separating and one going off on a wandering adventure someplace, not knowing when he's coming back and not having any good reason for going, and just a mutual agreement to be separated, and you do your pleasure, and I'll do my pleasure, and if we ever get together again, fine. If we don't, that's fine too. That's the attitude a lot of couples have, you know. But that's not what he's teaching here. Verse 6, but I speak this by permission and not of commandment. But I would that all men were even as I myself. Now he says that it's he'd be satisfied if everybody were just like he is, that is in an unmarried state. But every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. Now this even as I is in that unmarried, single state in which the man is not touching a woman. Can you imagine the Apostle Paul living as an apostle, living in the unmarried state, and having dates with women just right and left, and all kinds of dating relationships? And you know, he said, well, it's good to be like I am. I'm really a great esquire. I'm really somebody that all the women run after, but marriage is not for me. Can you imagine that? So he said, it's good for you to remain even as I. In verse 9, but if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. Now here we are talking about this unmarried state. He said, it's good to be like I am, but if you cannot contain, that is, if you're not exercising the proper control over your body, over the use of your emotions and feelings, then he says, let them marry. It's better to marry than to burn. Now, some interpret this better to marry than it is to burn in hell, but I think what he's saying here, it's better to marry than to burn with passion. It's better to marry than to lust and to desire to be with somebody and not be that way. And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband. Talking about husband and wife now, here's a basic principle of marriage. Let not the wife depart from her husband, but and if she depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And unmarried here would have to mean not in the sense that she is absolutely freed from the marriage tie to her husband, but unmarried in that she is not living with her husband, or be reconciled to her husband. She's got a choice of one of two things if she departs from him. She remains in a single unmarried state, or she is reconciled to her husband. And let not the husband put away his wife. That's all he says about the husband leaving his wife or putting his wife away. He says, just let not the husband put away his wife. There is no putting away. It's ever permitted in the New Testament. So when you marry, then you're not to depart. You're not to put them away. And if there's some reason that the wife should depart, she remains in the unmarried state or she is reconciled to her husband. One of the two things. So here again we have some very deep and abiding principles that do apply to the marriage state, and I wanted to interject those as we're studying about marriage and the duties of marriage. Now let's look at some more scriptures, though, that also would apply to the husband's duty to his wife, and that he should incorporate in his knowledge of how to dwell with his wife. In 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 10 through 13, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. Now this teaches that the husband is the provider, really. That if any would not work, neither should he eat. For we hear that there are some which walk among you disorderly, working not at all, but are busybodies. Now them that are such we command and exhort by our Lord Jesus Christ, that with quietness they work and eat their own bread. Now here is one of the rules for God's people, and of course we're talking in particular to the husband, that if any wouldn't work, neither should he eat. The Bible just does not make provision for the keeping up or the support of somebody who will not work. Now this is not talking about somebody who cannot work. Somebody who is unable to work. It's talking about somebody who will not work. It's not talking about somebody who works and who's not able to make enough for his needs either, but it's talking about somebody who will not work. Neither should he eat. Now that principle there, I guarantee you, would take a bunch of people off of welfare and off of food stamps and would get this thing to rolling again about how to economically and judiciously supply for the needs and the wants of the people. If anybody would not work, now I'm not talking about those who are not able. If anybody would not work, neither should he eat. After a while, they'd be looking for a job of some kind. And so he says that you, with quietness, you work and eat your own bread. Now, we're talking about the husband living with the wife according to knowledge. Work with quietness and eat your own bread. Again, in 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, we have another principle that's right along that same line. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Now here he's talking specifically about a person who is taking care of his family. And the real subject here is a widow indeed. Now that the church is not to be charged with the care of a widow indeed if she has relatives who can support her. And nephews are one of the things that he names. And certainly would include her children. And then he says, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. An infidel is somebody who is unfaithful, who has overthrown the faith, who has left the faith and has gone back into disorderly living. Well, he says this person, although he may be posing as a Christian, he may be posing as a faithful person, he has denied the faith and he is worse than an infidel. He might as well completely give up trying to be a Christian life and not supporting his own, not providing for his own. And again, we have this taught in Ephesians 4. Verse 28, he says, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands, a thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. Now, he's talking here about a person who might have a tendency to steal. Now, you know, there's lots of ways to steal besides actually just picking up something that belongs to somebody else and putting it in your pocket and walking off with it. Stealing is still a very common and a very prevalent thing in our society today. I heard a little program here last week where that in the state of Arizona that 1 out of every 10 shoppers is a shoplifter. 1 out of every 10 is a shoplifter, which is a very, very high percentage if you ask me. And just people who really don't regard it as being anything real bad. They just go into this big store and they don't think they're stealing from an individual. They just take something. Well, there's lots of other ways to steal. You know, you can cheat on your income tax. You can lie. You can steal in so many ways. You can work for somebody and pretend that you're putting out a day's work and really you're not working a full day. And that's stealing. There's lots of ways to steal. And most people steal because this is a means that they use to get gain by not working for it. You can't have worked for something and earned it and still at the same time have been guilty of stealing it. Well, he says, let him that stole steal no more. Just stop this stealing. What do you do instead of stealing? Rather, he says, let him labor with his hands. Rather, let him labor, working with his hands, the thing which is good. Now, he can't have just any kind of a job. Just any kind of an occupation, not going to get the job done here for a Christian. He must work the thing that's good. He must have an occupation that is acceptable and compatible with Christianity. Work with his hands, the thing that's good. It's certainly no disgrace to be a laborer of some kind where you work with your hands. The thing that's good. And what's the result of this? That he may have to give to him that needeth. Not only then are you going to be able to provide for your own needs, but you'll have to give to him that needeth. You'll have enough abundance left over from this kind of a production, enough abundance left over that you can give to him that needeth. So every husband should enter into the marriage relationship with this frame of mind. I'm to work. I'm not to steal. I'm to work with my hands, the thing that's good, so that I may have to give to him that needeth. If I don't work, I'm not worthy of eating. If any man shouldn't work, neither should he eat. If I fail to provide for my own, I am worse than an infidel, and I have denied the faith. Those are just some things that are taught very, very plainly, and it is certainly a part of the total picture that goes into marriage. Well, let's look at another scripture here. In Titus 2, verse 2, he's giving some instructions here for different classifications of people, and he starts talking to the aged men, that the aged men be. Now, as we learn how a man is to be in the Christian walk, then we also learn how that a man is to be when he dwells with his wife. That's the knowledge that he should also apply as he dwells with his wife. And this class of men here, he calls aged men. And we don't know exactly where you draw the line and call who you call aged men. In the days that Paul wrote this, an aged man might have been in his 40s, because the lifespan wasn't nearly as long then as it is now. In Puerto Rico today, the average lifespan is about 35. So, you know, well, this may be talking to a lot of us when he says aged men. But these are the goals that we should strive for, and these are the qualities that we should have in our homes, as well as in the church. That the aged men be sober, grave, temperate, sound in faith, in charity, in patience. Now let's look at what he's saying here. That the aged men be sober. This word sober, really, it's used several times in this passage, and it has different meanings. This word sober here means vigilance, or vigilant. And to be vigilant means that you are on the lookout, that you're looking for problems, and that you're not only looking for problems, but you see trouble before it really has a chance to brew, and before it gets out of hand, and you're on top of it. Well, he's talking really about the church, but it also applies to the home. So that this husband, this man, as he grows older, and as he acquires age, and as he acquires maturity, he is on top of all the problems that enter into his family and that might affect the course of his family. He's not the cash-for-milk-toast type that sits back and just lets things happen, and he exercises no control, no forethought, and no intervention into the affairs of his family. He's a vigilant person. He's on the lookout for trouble. Secondly, grave. That he be grave. This word grave really means to have a rational mind. That is, he logically attacks the problems that face his family, that are involved in his home, that are involved with his children and with his wife and his relationships. He rationally and logically attacks the problems. It's not enough sometimes just to say, do not do this, or I do not want you doing so and so, without being able to rationally and logically explain why it shouldn't be done, and why it's this way, or why it's that way. This requires use of the brain, it requires some study, it requires some application of yourself. It's so easy sometimes just to sit back and let things happen, and things that you know are not right, or that you know are not really the best, but it's so much easier, the course of least resistance, to just let it go. But this aged man is to be grave, he's to be rational. Thirdly, he says temperate. And the word temperate means that he's able to exercise self-control. He can control himself. That's not very good grounds for teaching someone if you tell them to do as I say and do not do as I do. I want you to control yourself, although I'm not able to control myself. I don't want you to smoke, but I smoke. I don't want you to drink, but I drink. I don't want you to use this kind of language, but I use this kind of language. I don't want you to behave in a certain manner, but I behave in this manner. Exercise self-control. Be able to control yourself. And you should be able to say to your children, I want you to do what I do. I'm setting the pattern for you. You can use any word I use. You can use any kind of drug or any kind of medicine or any kind of entertainment that I use, because I'm setting the pattern. I'm able to control myself. The next thing he named is sound in the faith. He should be sound in the faith. Oh, there's so many husbands and wives who would like to teach their children, but they just don't know enough about the Bible to even begin. They are so ignorant of God's plan themselves They've always depended upon somebody else, if they depended upon anybody at all, to do the teaching of their children and even of themselves, that they know nothing about the Bible, and consequently they are totally incompetent and unable to teach the Bible. And they're not sound in the faith. But one of the qualities of this man is that he be sound in the faith, that he know enough about the Bible, that he has a stand, he knows why he believes it, and he can defend his belief. The next quality is in charity. Sound in charity. Now, to be sound in charity is love. Or I don't mean necessarily that he be sound in charity, but that he be in charity. That's the quality of love. We've talked about it a lot. It's mentioned many, many times. We're not going to belabor the subject again here, but love is simply that ability not to work any ill to your neighbor. And of course, it would apply in the church, it would apply in the home, it would apply in every relationship of our life and our everyday walk, that he be in charity or in this state of love, able to show what love is. And 99 and 100% of all people probably can't even give you a definition of what love is, much less really know how to exhibit it. Because love is an emotion that is controlled by a sound understanding of what it is. And it's not just an emotion only. And then lastly, he says, in patience. And this word here for patience means that he be stable, that he be able to hold on to the end. He's not a wishy-washy, double-minded, unstable, unsure person. He has definite concepts and beliefs. He has a philosophy that is according to sound basic principles, and he holds on to it through thick and thin. He is stable. These are qualities now that a husband should develop and have in the home. And to have these then would be necessary if he's going to dwell with his wife according to knowledge. Dwell with her according to knowledge. So that he be vigilant, that he be rational, that he have self-control, that he be well-learned in the faith, that he have love, and that he have stability or patience. That's what Timothy is teaching here to the older men. Rather, that's what Paul is teaching to Titus, to the older men. Well, we have other qualities that are also given. In 1 Timothy 3, I'd like to read another one. In the qualification given for bishops, in 1 Timothy 3, in the 4th verse, he says, "One that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" Now this is a quality that is for a bishop, but it's for a bishop reflected from how he has conducted himself in his own home. And all of these qualities of a bishop, with the exception of a very few, would apply to every Christian. And this quality would apply to every male Christian who has a house, who has children, who has a wife, a family. One that ruleth well his own house. Now, this means, first of all, that this basic principle of the wife being in subjection to the husband and the children being in subjection to the parents, that principle is in effect. He rules well his own house. But not only does he rule his own house, but he rules his own house well, in that he has his children in subjection with all gravity. Now, the home here is used as a proving grounds to determine how well a man could rule the church as a bishop. And the home is the test. How well is he going to be able to take care of the church of God? How well is to reflect it by how well he does in his home. And he says, "For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" Now this taking care of the church of God is not ruling in the same sense of ruling in his own home. The whole church is not just subject to one person in the church like they are the head of the house. But nevertheless, that's a test as to how well he rules his home, is a test as to how well he'll be able to take care of the church of God. And the implication is that if he doesn't do a good job at home, he's not going to do a good job at church. So one that ruleth his own house well, having his children in subjection with all gravity. That is, he has children who are under his control, and they're subject to those matters that are of importance. All gravity. As we go on down to the 12th verse of this same chapter, he's talking about the deacons. Let the deacons be the husbands of one wife. Now that's also said about the bishops. Be the husbands of one wife. Not only are we the husbands of one wife, but we don't desire to be the husband of any other wife. Only one wife. The husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own houses well. Here again, those who would use the office of deacon, one of the qualifications for it was ruling their own house and their children well. So these are features that husbands must incorporate into their body of knowledge when they are going to learn how to dwell with their wives according to knowledge. Dwell with them according to knowledge. So notice some of the features that we've covered now. The one of submission. Another of love. Love to the wife. Love to the wife as Christ loves the church. Duties of marriage involving such duties as the sexual relationship and the not defrauding or depriving one another of the due benevolence. Giving honor to the wife. Then the fact that he's to work and to provide for his own home. And the fact that he's to rule his home and to rule his own house well. Well, we're going to close at that point this evening, and then next time we're going to continue this same subject and elaborate upon the duties of wives to husbands, the duties of wives.